Fictional heroine Laurie Sasslin has a lot of great qualities. She's smart, kind, and funny. She's a talented journalist and student of nature. She's confident in who she is and loves her family and friends with fierce devotion. But she's not a detective, or a spy, or an expert in antiquities, so she has to learn all of that on the fly as she's plunged into a mystery she uncovers at her great-aunt Dot's house. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. To help her solve the puzzle, Laurie enlists the help of two of her nearest and dearest, a childhood friend and her very first love, who both still live in her hometown. Linda Holmes is an author and pop culture correspondent for NPR. You probably know her from the podcast Pop Culture Happy Hour. Her second novel is called Flying Solo, and she joins us now to talk about it. Linda, welcome back to Think.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
There's so much to talk about in this book, but I've got to hear a little bit about what it was like to write this one. Weren't you writing it during the worst part of the pandemic?
Well, yeah. I mean, maybe the second worst part. I mean, I think if the first worst part was kind of summer of 2020, I wrote a lot of this during 2021. So I wrote this book kind of across the period of time when I was waiting, with great impatience to get vaccinated, finally getting out in the world with other people. And I had found writing during the pandemic to be extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people felt like, well, this will be a great time to write because, you don't have that much else to do. And there's some truth to that, but at the same time, I also found my energy was really low. I really struggled. So it was quite difficult. It took me a long time to get moving. It took me a long time to kind of get to the story that I wanted to tell. Definitely a tough experience.
I remember hearing that over and over again from people and setting myself up for similar kind of goals. I'm like, oh, it's a pandemic. I'll make sure the house is neat as a pin since I'm working from home. I'll do laundry. I'll do lots of pleasure pursuits like writing and reading. And then I remember finding out that I was actually like less inclined to do any of that than I would have been before the pandemic. Didn't matter that I was home. I was just so anxious and distracted.
Definitely. And, I live by myself. So it was really just me I really did not see anybody with the exception of just a couple of outdoor, hangouts with other people. I mostly didn't see anybody for about a year. And so, for me, if you're not seeing other people, it changes the whole shape of your mental outlook. It changes my ability to have ideas when you're not bumping into other people regularly. You don't necessarily have the same circulation of thoughts. And I found it really easy to, and to some degree, it was a coping mechanism and it was what it was. And I don't have any regrets, but I found it very easy to just kind of shut myself down. And in some ways, I've talked to people about the fact that there are times during that period, especially in that first year, there were times when I don't really remember anything. Mm-hmm. I almost feel like I didn't form memories during part of that time.
That's so interesting. Do you think, obviously that was a big challenge with writing book two. Were there any just book two challenges? You hear a lot about second book slumps or second show slumps if you're in a play. What was the biggest hurdle that you had to jump creatively when it came to putting pen to paper for this one?
Boy, I'll tell you, I wish that I were not such a cliche, but it is really true that I think writing a second book for me, one of the really smart things that my editor said to me at one point was the stakes in some ways are lower, but they feel higher. I had one book come out that had done well. And I think when that happens, you have this moment of feeling like, do I want to write something that's kind of similar to the first book? Do I want to write something that's really different so that I don't pigeonhole myself? And, I was in that position where, you cannot possibly complain about a book being successful. That's mm-hmm. a silly thing to do, but it does create a different kind of pressure, or at least it did for me. I didn't want to disappoint anybody. I didn't want to disappoint the team that I work with. My publisher is really lovely to me, and it was definitely, I got very much in my own head about it. And it did take a long time to get out of that.
So tell me how you settled on where this book would be set. Were you originally planning to head back to the town that was featured in your first book, Evie Drake Starts Over?
I wasn't at all. I really didn't have any further plans for that town. I don't have any further plans for it now. But as I, found myself in this kind of stuck place, I did feel like I maybe wanted something just a little bit familiar, and I maybe wanted something with a little bit of capacity to bring me some comfort. By not starting completely from scratch. And there were a couple of kind of I guess I would call them peripheral characters in the first book that I had really enjoyed and thought about going back to. So I was able to go back to a couple of those folks a little bit, although for the most part it's a totally different story. I think it was just a matter of it gave me something to hold on to at that time that was really difficult. Going back to this town and this, world that was already partially built in my own mind, just gave me a little extra structure that I needed at that moment.
Is it just bizarre to have created a place from scratch and then feel compelled by it? I mean, what must that be like to have a tug of familiarity towards some place you invented? That's kind of creatively mind-blowing to me.
It's interesting because, it is a mix of it's a place that I invented, but it's also in some ways a real place that I love in the sense that my family used to vacation in this part of Maine when I was young. So it's a place that I invented mentally, but it also gives me a sense of real familiarity. And when I am writing about lobster boats and buoys and looking out at the water and these towns that I really have great affection for. It's fiction and also not fiction. So yeah, I mean, in some ways it is a world of my own making, but it's also based on real places and borrowed from real places in many ways.
Tell us a little bit more about the town for those who haven't read your first book. Tell us a little bit about this corner of Maine. What's it like?
Well, Calcasset is a town that is situated in sort of mid-coast Maine. So if you know Maine, kind of the Rockland, Camden kind of area. And it's a town that used to be more of a lobster fishing town than it is now. There is still lobster fishing that goes on there. It also has a lot of tourist activity, as a lot of those towns do. So the people who live there, have some combination of affection for and frustration with tourism and visitors, which of course is the kind of person I was when I was there. But it also has a few other things. It now has, as of this book, a really beautiful public library. It has a minor league baseball team. It has, lighthouses and a lot of the really beautiful stuff that I love out there. But it's also made up of, working people, including a lot of working lobster boat fishermen and things like that.
So this book, Flying Solo, starts out with this really wonderful little scene. And this is back when Lori, who's the protagonist of the book, was 12 years old. And it really establishes her relationship with her aunt Dot, who's actually her great aunt. So why was Dot's house such a refuge for Lori?
Well, Lori is a character who grew up with four brothers. She's right in the middle, so she has two older and two younger. And her brothers were, for her, kind of a raucous, loving but noisy group of kids. And I think she always felt like she needed a little bit of quiet. She is that person. She values quiet. She values, being able to find a quiet place to read a book. And so she spends a lot of time as a kid at Dot's house because they all live close together. She can get there on her bike. So when she's young, she goes over there and kind of, Dot lives by herself and has this beautiful house that Lori loves. And so she spends a lot of time over there kind of having a little bit of quiet, but also a little bit of one-on-one time that is hard to get in her particular big, noisy family.
Tell us about the goldfish room, because I was just screaming how much I loved this.
So one of the things that Lori learns about Dot is that Dot owns her own house, and therefore she can do whatever she wants with it. And I think for a lot of people who have ever bought their first house, you have that moment where you think, oh, if I'm not renting, one of the nice things is I can, paint the walls however I want. I can put the holes in the walls if I want. I can change whatever I want. Obviously in keeping with whatever my resources are. And Lori makes a comment to Dot about, Lori is staying in one of the bedrooms and Dot says to her, "What's your favorite color?" And Lori says, orange, kind of goldfish orange. And Dot responds by kind of saying, "Let's paint this room orange. It's my house. I can paint the room orange if I want." And it makes a big impression on Lori in that opening scene in the prologue, because it really gives her a sense of having your own space, consulting with no one. I think Lori feels like in her house, you have to ask a whole bunch of people in order to schedule anything or do anything or, make any plans. Dot says, "Let's paint the room orange." And so they paint the room orange.
So what are some other qualities that kind of belong to Dot that really connect with Lori, both when she's like a kid and a teenager, but also as an adult? The two of them have a real relationship that really does transcend time. It's not one of those books where we're going to get to the part where Lori says, "Oh man, I wish I'd kept in touch." Like, they really do have a very valuable relationship throughout her life.
Yeah. I mean, I think she winds up feeling, as many people do, "I wish I had visited more. I wish I had called her more." But it's not because they weren't close. They're close because, Lori is in the book, in the main part of the book, Lori is almost 40. She's just decided not to get married. She's just called off a wedding. And Dot was somebody who never got married and never had kids, but had a really wonderful and exciting life of love and relationships and boyfriends and travel, and she had a job that she loved in a school where she worked with kids, and she had these very close relationships with her nieces and nephews and great nieces and nephews. And so she had a very, very full life, even though to some people it would have looked lonely or solitary. And I think Lori has in common with Dot that desire to be to have both love and support, but also a lot of autonomy and a lot of individual choice. And she's trying to figure out kind of where is the line between, obviously, closeness involves cooperating with other people about big decisions, but at the same time, can you have that and also have the part of yourself that wants to paint a room orange whenever you want?
It's so refreshing to me as I read more books like this one or even young adult fiction today. I feel like there is so much less emphasis on you're not complete until you've found your other half. And so many characters are allowed to enjoy solitude and enjoy kind of the serenity that comes with making their own schedule and having agency. And that's something I really see with Lori. Like, Lori is not going to ever bemoan a night reading with a glass of wine by herself. That's not something to be pitied. It's something to be celebrated.
Not at all. And, she says at one point, "I don't necessarily prefer to be by myself, but I'm also not afraid of it." And that, I think, is, to be clear, I think you're absolutely right that fiction that depicts a romantic relationship or the thoughts about a romantic relationship has become better and better at more explicitly going outside of that model of, you want to get married, you want to move in together and have, X many children, and the relationships are all, heterosexual, and they're entered into in their 20s. And, a lot of fiction well before me has been, more and more open to growing beyond what those relationship models might mean to different people.
Can you kind of set up, Linda, why is Lori back in her hometown? This is on the book jacket, so we're not spoiling anything, but why is she back at her Aunt Dot's house?
Sure. So Aunt Dot, as of the beginning of the main body of the book, has passed away. And Lori is the person in her family who decides she's going to take responsibility for the estate. Dot didn't have kids. She doesn't have a surviving spouse. She was 93, so she's accumulated a lot of things that she loved. She was, as I was talking about before, a traveler. So she has a lot of souvenirs. She has a lot of pictures. And Lori takes responsibility for going through those things because she really believes that, the fact that you don't have that surviving spouse or those kids doesn't mean that you don't deserve to have your life honored and your possessions cared for in exactly the same way that a person would do for a romantic partner or their own kid, or excuse me, their own parent.
And, you know, her Lori's parents can't really do this. They're not really in, I mean, they live in Florida. They're, you know, older themselves. Lori's brothers are, you know, each one of them had, you know, the perfect excuse why they can't be the one going through the house. So, of course, kind of it seemed obvious just based on how little we even knew of Lori at the beginning of the book that it was going to fall to her. But Lori also has kind of an interesting profession that gives her a little bit of flexibility. So tell me about what Lori does for a living, where she lives, and what kind of journalist she is.
Lori lives in the Pacific Northwest, and she is a kind of a wildlife and nature journalist, a science journalist. She's she had a job, a regular job at a kind of a successful nature and science magazine for a long time doing features. But now she's freelance, so she works in different places. She also picks up a little bit of, you know, as a lot of writers do, a certain amount of, you know, trade writing and things like that. So she does a lot of different stuff. She is about, you know, at the beginning of the book, she's looking forward to an assignment about turtle trafficking. It's the kind of reporting that she loves to do. She loves, you know, to go out and also in her free time, just go out and look at bugs and animals and birds and things like that. So it's a curiosity about the world that has allowed her to do a lot of different things.
So you, Linda, do you have a particular interest in this? Because this was so like well written that it has to come from a place of love, right? Are you just especially curious about nature?
Well, you know, I grew up in a house where there were, you know, a couple acres of woods behind the house that were ours. And so you know, we would go back there and just kind of tromp around. I mean, it wasn't anything fancy at all. It was unadorned. You know, go back there. There was a pond back there. It was always real swampy and smelly and things like that. We had different berry bushes and all that. So I think from a young age, I spent a lot of time tromping around in nature myself. My family was a big camping family. And so I think I do have that curiosity. My parents are birders. So I come by all of that pretty honestly. And then obviously, you know, I do a certain kind of feature journalism, and I certainly have many, many friends who do feature journalism. So it's kind of a collision of things that I enjoy thinking about and writing about.
I was going to say, what a fun process to kind of do the research to make sure that Lori's journalism feels really honest. That must have been really interesting to get to read up on some of that special in-depth feature nature writing, which is always so delightful to read.
Yeah, I tried to find some good things that she might be interested in and curious about right now. I did try to find some things for her to focus on and to know about, you know, when something would come up. She's one of those people who kind of has a way of knowing a little something about everything. Mm-hmm. And I tried to have enough at my fingertips that it would feel like she had a complete career and that her interests were genuine.
So I love the little scene where you describe how she, when she was looking for her house in the Pacific Northwest, how like completely committed she was to finding a quiet place, how she was, you know, doing wall testing, like the wall thinness checks and listening to the neighbors, and really growing up in the middle of a pack of brothers has really stayed with her.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't buy a house of my own until I was in my 40s. So I lived in a lot of apartments, and they ranged from places that were pretty quiet to places where I would wake up in the middle of the night. And I mean, even when I lived downstairs from my landlord, I would wake up in the middle of the night and she'd be having insomnia and she'd be upstairs moving furniture. And it just is one of those things. You can't be mad. It's living with other people. But, you know, she is somebody who really wanted the ability to turn everything off, and that when you were quiet, it would be really, really quiet. And that is, I will freely admit, something I love about my own house.
That's great. So as you mentioned in the first segment, Lori has had a pretty like major event in her personal life semi-recently before she makes it to Great Aunt Dot's house. So what happened with her relationship? She decided not to move forward with her wedding.
Yeah, she had a couple of longer term relationships, but she, you know, she was getting into her late 30s, and she had met somebody, and she had decided, you know, yes, this is who I'm going to marry. And they were pretty far into the process. They were close to the wedding, and she decided that it just wasn't what she wanted and it wasn't going to work out. And so she called it off, and she has a certain amount of, I think, both guilt and relief about that. Often emotions that go hand in hand, I think. She knows, I think she knows she did the right thing for herself, but she's obviously feeling a little bruised by it and really wondering, does this mean I don't ever want to get married? Does it just mean I didn't want to marry this guy? How would I know another time if I did want to get married, or if I, you know, am I committed to the idea that I'm not going to have kids? And she's trying to figure out all those things at this moment that feels kind of heightened for her.
Can you please share the story of the problematic waffle maker that has kind of become emblematic of her breakup? I wouldn't say it's the reason, but it is like some of the best writing I've ever read. I really enjoyed it because we've all been there where there's just like a moment that may feel perfunctory, but it really meant something to you and it changes everything.
Yeah, she tells the story of having been out registering for wedding gifts, and you know, you're out with the little scanner and you beep this and you beep this and beep this. And her fiance really wanted to get a smart waffle maker, which was this very elaborate, you know, you can interchange the waffle plates and all that stuff. He really wants to buy it. She doesn't think they have room for it. And it's just a moment that really crystallizes for her that they have really different priorities, not just because he wants to get this thing, even though he doesn't eat breakfast and she doesn't understand that. It seems illogical, but also she doesn't think, you know, she's wondering, why do I have to make space for this? And she's starting to really think about those compromises, not just the big compromises in life, but the number of smaller compromises that she's about to make about her living situation and whether it's really worth it.
And it's interesting to me because all of that, I mean, you can really kind of see moving through that conversation as Lori. I mean, you know, we've all been there, but it also amused me that clearly, like, she finds this product ridiculous and unnecessary, like, on all fronts. And now she's rethinking, have I hitched my wagon to a star that thinks this is in any way a good idea to own? And to me, like, even just that little tiny difference in how you see the world can probably make you question almost all of your choices.
I'm not going to lie. I had a friend who had a registration for a wedding gift situation where they had these really strong feelings of, you know, this is a really great thing that we need. That is a really dumb thing that we don't need between the two people. And I always thought it was interesting to think about how that reflected where they were in their heads at that time. So she's at this moment where she both, when she tells the story, she thinks, well, this sounds ridiculous. It sounds ridiculous for me to say that this is what made me realize I wanted to call off my wedding. But she also has that moment of, I really don't want to marry somebody who wants to spend, or who wants to ask other people to spend this kind of money on a waffle maker that plays songs and has an app attached to it, because that's silly. And that's, so she's stubborn in that way, and she doesn't necessarily want to have to give up being stubborn about certain things. So yeah, it's a story that's drawn a little bit from some real life examples.
That's great. So now Lori's back. She's in her hometown. She's sorting through her great aunt Dot's possessions. But Dot's house has this very specific kind of clutter to it. It's not dirty. She's not a hoarder. It's not like a disorganized nightmare. Her house is just kind of stuffed with all of the experience she accumulated throughout her life. Can you kind of paint us a picture? It's not just like a mess. It's just brimming.
Yeah, not at all. She's actually, I think, quite organized. She has you know, a lot of, Lori notes at one point, she's kind of clearly changed direction about her collecting at certain times in her life as she traveled. So there was a time when she was collecting little egg cups, and a time when she was collecting spoons from different places. She owns tons and tons of postcards. She took many, many, many pictures. But everything is sort of neatly organized, and the pretty things are on display for the most part. So she has everything kind of well cared for. She also has a lot of things left from hobbies that she's pursued. She's taken lots of classes and has a lot of the kind of, as we all do, the kind of craft room, you know, stuff that you accumulate. Right. I have a lot of it around me as we speak. So she's an organized person, but she's a person who's accumulated a lot of stuff because she didn't really ever have any particular either desire or need to purge her stuff, because she stayed in her house until she died, 93 years after she was born into that same house.
So after I finished reading the book, I thought, I mean, we don't really hear Dot talk very often in the book. We have a couple scenes, like the one when Laurie was young, a few phone calls where we get to hear her voice. We see a couple little things that she's labeled, but you really created her character, and a lot of her character is reflected through her home. Was that an interesting process? I've never done that kind of writing where you know a character so well that you can figure out, you know, what kind of photos she'd take and how she may stack them up and what things she might line her shelves with. That must have been a really interesting character study for someone who we don't hear a lot from.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think it's always difficult to write a story that is heavily reliant on a person who is not alive for most of the book without having it turn into pure sentimentality and other people's memory, which is always so incredibly subjective because you get a lot of Laurie's memory of her. But the nice thing about looking at people's stuff is that there's a truth to it. There's a, you know, these are the things that she had in her home on the day that she died. And there's something about that that is frank in a way that memory sometimes isn't. So there's almost a, you know, there is that plain spoken way that when you open someone's literal closet, you are looking at, here are the letters that she chose to keep. Here are the things she never got rid of. And some of it, you know, will always be opaque to you. You're never going to fully understand all of the reasons why she, you know, everything about her life from what she kept, but you learn a lot. And, you know, Laurie finds herself kind of looking at, you know, she had a lot of books and she used different funny things as bookmarks. And sometimes it seems to have had meaning and sometimes it doesn't seem to have had meaning. Sometimes the meaning is probably just not obvious. So yeah, it was great fun to me. And I had a real, fondness for that character and a real, I think, understanding of her, even though, you know, you're not writing a lot of scenes in which she's actually a presence.
So talk to me a little bit about the mystery at hand. So again, this is all stuff that's, you know, kind of outlined in the book summary, so we're not going to ruin anything fun, but there is something really kind of interesting and exciting that plays out as Laurie is going through Great Aunt Dot's possessions.
Yeah. I mean, as I mentioned, Laurie finds that a lot of Dot's things are beautifully displayed. They are very well organized. And so she's very surprised when she finds that at the bottom of this basically blanket chest, there's a very pretty duck decoy and a very pretty painted wood duck decoy. And she's not sure why, you know, her aunt was not a hunter. Why does she have a duck decoy? And why in particular is this thing that seems really beautiful at the bottom of this blanket chest? And she also finds a letter that seems to kind of opaquely allude to ducks. And she starts to wonder, like, is that letter related to this duck decoy? And so because she's a journalist, because she's a curious person, it kind of eats at her. She's just really curious about it. And it gives her, you know, I think it also kind of gives her something fun to do and something fun to think about. So she becomes really absorbed in trying to figure out initially, I think, where did this come from? Ultimately, you know, does it have monetary value? Is it quote unquote special as someone else would define that? You know, did she collect it from somewhere? So she gets kind of sucked into trying to figure out what the story of the decoy is.
And who would ever think that the story of a duck decoy or researching one would lead her on quite an adventure? That, again, when you look at it on its face, there's going to be a mystery about a wooden duck. Maybe it doesn't seem, you know, ripe for twists and turns, but man, the saga really gets going.
I mean, I think I got very interested in, I got very interested in antiques during the pandemic because I was watching so much Antiques Roadshow, candidly, and I got very interested in the stories that people brought about, you know, how they came to own something, where they found it, who owned it before them. And even though the decoy initially just seems like kind of an odd thing to find, she becomes curious about it. And she also has to deal with some of the pragmatic things that happen when you clean out someone's home, because the death of someone that you love has many, many, many effects. But one of them is that it creates work that has to be done. And she gets some help with that work from one of these kind of people who comes in and helps downsize or clean out when someone dies. So she's kind of talking to that guy about, you know, what she's going to do, what the story of the duck is. So she gets kind of sucked into this antiques, this world of collectibles and antiques, which she doesn't know a lot about. So she's sort of trying to work her way through that. She's trying to work her way through a lot of personal stuff. She's still kind of smarting from the wedding. So yeah, there's a lot going on. A lot going on.
And what's interesting is I think we can all relate to that. Anytime you lose a loved one, there is quite a bit of work to be done. And it also requires you putting trust in people that you may not know very well.
Definitely. And you know, it's interesting. I was talking to some people who work in the antiques industry, and you know, they were saying it is something that unfortunately is pretty common because, you know, when you're dealing with people's beloved things, you have to be really scrupulously trustworthy, or you can really hurt people and wind up, you know, doing a lot of harm. And so one of the things she's discovering is the importance of dealing with really honest people when you're dealing with anything valuable. And she sort of doesn't want to be in an argument about, I think, the monetary value of the thing until she finds that she sort of has to be. So yeah, it is a real, you know, it's a point of vulnerability, and every point of vulnerability is capable of exploitation. And I think that's one of the things she finds, is that when you're vulnerable and you're dealing with grief and also work, that is a combination that sometimes is exploited.
Tell us a little bit about June and Lori and June's relationship in particular.
Well, June and Lori were childhood best friends, and they had, you know, one of those kind of separations because Lori decided she did not want to stay in her hometown when she grew up, and June did stay. And I think staying and going in a lot of these smaller communities is something that can really be a source of tension for them. I think they were largely able to overcome it. They do talk a lot. You know, I think they have one of those friendships that's really benefited from things like FaceTime and, you know, the opportunity to chat. June has kids and is married. Lori doesn't have kids and isn't married. And I think it's almost like they both expect there to be a little bit more difference between them over that fact than there actually is. And Lori has it a little bit in her head that, well, this is the other way to go, where you're completely enmeshed with somebody else and it's wonderful for the reasons it's wonderful, but I couldn't do it for the reasons I couldn't do it. So she learns a lot about, I think, being a married person from at least one example of June, in addition to the examples of, you know, her parents and some of her brothers.
And Lori and June have that great adult friendship that we all love and want more of, where they do, it's very respectful, it's real, but also, you know, they do occasionally call each other out on misperceptions and when someone's maybe headed down the wrong path and is being a little bit unfair and painting with broad strokes. And it's really nice to see it's not like a typical, like, I can predict this friendship in a book kind of friendship. They really are very honest with each other and are also accountable when they make a misstep.
Yeah, I think one of the things I wanted to avoid is when you're trying to write a book that respects the independence of people who are single, which is one of the things I wanted to do in this story, you don't want to wind up not respecting the independence of people who are married or who have partners, because they also have their forms of independence which might look different or feel different. But it's wrong, as I think Lori learns from looking at June's life, it's wrong to assume that if you're married, you don't have to call on the skills that Lori prides herself on, her self-reliance and her ability to be, you know, as they talk about a number of times, quote unquote, independent. And I think, again, you know, during the pandemic, I think it was a time when I thought a lot about independence and interdependence, and the fact that even though I was living by myself, I was so dependent on the support of other people and, you know, their ability to reach out to me and care about me. So yeah, I think she learns from her relationship with June that you don't want to, you know, everybody has to have respect for all the lives they haven't tried. And I think that's one of the things that she learns about marriage from June, among other people.
So what do you want to share about Nick, who's someone else that Lori reconnects with?
Well, Nick is was Lori's high school boyfriend. They were very fond of each other, but they kind of went their separate ways. They had one of those relationships where I think when they left high school, it was sort of, we're going to stay together. And then, as most people do, they discovered how difficult that is. They again had really different feelings about staying or going. Nick, like June, has stayed in their hometown. He inherited kind of the legacy of the local public library from his parents, who ran it and shepherded it and deeply, deeply care about it. And he became eventually the director of that library and has spent a lot of time, you know, trying to keep it going and trying to get funding for it and having a lot of those battles that that public librarians often have. So Lori, when she gets back to town, she runs into him. He's divorced, but you know, they still have a lot of the same, honestly, the same conflicts that they had when they were young. They want different lives, and that appears again, but so does the fact that they really, really like and care about each other and respect each other and have this attraction and have a long history. So again, she's trying to sort of sort through, what do I want to do about the conflicts and those impulses that I'm really attracted to this person and care about him and feel like maybe he's a great person to have in my life, but I don't know whether our ideas of a relationship would ever be compatible as people who are, you know, both around 40. So,
and it's so much fun. I'm sorry that Nick is a librarian. I don't know why. That just, like, I just wrote the word on my notes when I was writing questions for the show, libraries, with a lot of exclamation points, because there's just something really charming about a public library, especially it looks like this one has been, like, beautifully maintained in a lovely building and has, like, real champions behind it. Why is it so fun to write about libraries?
Listen, it's pandering, but it's also true that I really love libraries. Yes. And librarians. And I have really had such wonderful experiences getting to know people who work around and for libraries and also who care for any of the institutions in their communities. And I think, you know, I think in the last year or two, you've seen a lot of these conflicts that come up over books and books that people do want or don't want to have in libraries, and how librarians are incredibly dedicated, sometimes at great cost to themselves, to making sure that people can have access to the widest range of books and experiences and materials. And also, you know, librarians are trying to deal, a lot of them just are coming out of such a difficult experience with COVID and such a difficult experience with funding, and really are up against it in terms of the kind of being respected for their ability to adapt to tech. I mean, there are still people who kind of say, what do you need libraries for? Don't I get my books? You know, what about the internet? Well, yeah, the library is where a lot of people get the internet, and it's where a lot of people access and use the internet, and it's the people who can help you find what you need there. So I have a legit great enthusiasm for libraries and librarians and the ones that I have loved and benefited from having in my life, going back to obviously school libraries when I was a kid and public libraries now, and honestly the librarians who work at NPR and, you know, all the research people whose work I call on every day.
So there's some great exploration of kind of what it means to be odd one out in this book. In Lori's case, you know, the only girl in a family of five kids. She talks a little bit later in the book about how she's a size 18 and explains that designers and retailers frequently kind of like exclude larger sizes from a lot of the offerings available to buy. But it seems like anything and everything that may have set Lori apart in any way also made her very strong and very self-assured.
I think that's right. I think one of the things that she's learned at some point is, you know, there are certain things that you just can't spend your life feeling awkward about, right? Because as you mentioned, one of the things she talks about is, because she's a nature writer, she spends a lot of time doing kind of outdoorsy activities. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of wonderful plus size retailers and plus size designers and things like that. But there are also some kinds of specialty clothing, one of which is outdoor / adventure / even athletic stuff, mm-hmm. where historically they've had a long way to go. And I think one of the things she's learned is there's just not a lot of benefit to letting that be about you. She sees that as about them. Mm-hmm. And You know, she's kind of gotten past, I think, being self-conscious about that stuff. She notices it. There's kind of a moment where she notices that she's around a lot of people who either have kids or want to have kids. She's kind of aware of her difference in that moment. But I think she's gotten pretty good at making that not about her and not about her adequacy.
So on kind of a light note, there's some fun, like you mentioned, little callbacks in this book to your first book. The one that amused me the most was the fictional TV show that you created, Halls of Power, that was a mainstay of our couple in book one. Now we have one of Lori's brothers was a kind of had a little small arc on this show.
Yeah, it's really funny. When I was doing my book tour with that book, I did an event with my buddy Eric Adams, who worked at the time at the AV Club in Chicago, and we sort of sat on stage and improvised a good chunk of the plot of Halls of Power, even though I had not really said very much about it in the book. And of course, that the name of the political family would be the Halls, obviously.
Of course.
You know, and we really kind of were playing around with it. And then I just kind of lifted that whole plot and brought it over into this book as the actual basis of Halls of Power, which is the kind of thing, it's so meaningless in many ways, but it's so much fun as a person who, like, oh, I can do this if I want to. I can just invent my whole TV show if I want to. And I can just take our improvised version of the plot and port it right over because it's my book.
So much fun. So I always ask people who are novelists when I have them on the show, what are you reading right now? What's like really just lighting you up?
I have read several books I've really liked this summer. One is a book by Alyssa Sussman called Funny You Should Ask, which is about also about a journalist. It's about a journalist who interviews, has a very like famous celebrity interview and then gets back together, you know, meets again with the guy she had this famous celebrity interview with many years later. Ooh. Loved that book. Really loved Susan Rigetti's book, which is called Cover Story, which is sort of a spin on Anna Delvey, the Anna Delvey story, the New York fake socialite kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Lots of just really super good stuff this summer. I've read a bunch of great books.
So Linda, when you decided that you wanted to write a book, and I know we've talked a little bit about your journey to kind of becoming an author, what did you always think this is the kind of story that you'd be after? This is what you'd want to pursue?
You know, I think I always wanted and still want to write the kind of book that I want to read. And mm-hmm. that is, it's not because I think that is the best way to write books. It's that it's the only way that I know how to do it. So for me, I love books that are kind of a combination of thoughtful and kind of warm and cozy. So I'm always going for that combination. I think I'm always trying to, I don't necessarily think of the books that I'm writing as like provocative. I think of them as challenging while also being joyful, I guess, especially now. I think a lot of people are just, they want to sort of have their brain poked a little bit, but they don't want to, they're not necessarily seeking out unpleasant experiences. At least they're not from me. So yeah, I think as a critic, I've learned to be really respectful of what I actually want and enjoy. And so that's kind of what I am always trying to write.
What is the feedback you've gotten about your characters that's meant the most to you as an author?
I think with both books, I've had people, you know, obviously we're a lot earlier in the cycle of this book, but with early readers of this book and with Evie, I've had a lot of readers who say, I felt like I understood this character and I felt like I understood where she was coming from. You know, Evie was a character who had been in a really bad marriage and an emotionally abusive marriage. Lori is somebody who kind of is feeling a little bit awkward about how she fits into the pictures of happiness that she's seen her whole life. And I think when people tell me, you know, I felt that my own view of the world was kind of being respected and reflected, but also reflected on, that means a great deal to me. That means a great deal to me.
Something I love about Lori is she's that person that we all know that it does a really wonderful job meeting new people and making friends. And she makes a couple friends in the book that she meets, and now they're friends. Mm-hmm. And there's just something about that that is so fun to read. Is that, I mean, I think maybe because we all aspire to be a little bit like that.
Yeah, I mean, I am not good at parties at all, and I'm not good with strangers necessarily at all, particularly in person. I'm much better, I'm much better on other people's podcasts. I don't adapt easily to in-person social situations. I'm probably even more out of practice now than I was 2 years ago or 3 years ago. But yeah, I think Lori is somebody who, partly because she's a journalist, again, she kind of has had to build up that callus of you have to be willing to go and ask people questions that you don't know, or you're going to have a hard time with reporting. And I know a lot of reporters who don't come to that naturally, but have built up that callus. So yeah, I admire that about her. I would love to, I mean, I will avoid cold calling people to order pizza. It is really, I am terrible at it and don't like doing it. But yeah, Lori's a, hey, I got a question. I'm going to go find the person who knows the answer to the question.
My guest this hour was Linda Holmes, co-host of Pop Culture Happy Hour and novelist. Her new book is called Flying Solo, a Novel. Linda, thank you so much for your time. What a great conversation.
Thank you very much. This was really, really fun. Thanks for having me.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle is at KERAThink. And subscribe to our podcast for free wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for KERAThink. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins in today for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.